April the 7th, 1994. This is the House State Affairs Committee, convened in Juneau, Alaska. Chairman Al Veazey present, Representative Pete Cott, Representative Jerry Sanders, Representative Harley Olberg. The first item I'd like to bring up on our agenda this morning is House Bill 543. We discussed this last time and we pointed out that it appeared that we were amending the wrong statute. That does appear to have been the case. Representative Olberg, you asked a question about why the Department of Public Safety is administering the plumbing code and the mechanical code. The authority for those references are Alaska Statute Title 18, Chapter 60, and Alaska Title 28, Chapter 05, Paragraph 011 to be exact. Anyway, the mechanical code is adopted by regulation. It is updated every 3 years. The method that we have put forth here for amending the mechanical code to allow unvented space heaters is simply to put in statute the standards set out by the National Standards Institute's accreditation program for unvented gas heaters. And if there aren't any questions, I'll entertain a motion. If there's discussion, why? Representative Olberg.
Mr. Chairman, I would move that we move committee substitute for House Bill 543 from State Affairs with individual recommendations.
Okay, can I include that motion, Representative Olberg, to include that we adopt version K of committee substitute for 543?
Absolutely.
Would the committee secretary please call the roll?
Representative Harley Olberg?
Yes.
Representative Jerry Sanders?
Yes.
Representative Peacock?
Yes.
Yes, and House Bill 543 has passed from the House State Affairs Committee. The next item I'd like to bring up on our agenda is House Bill 531. Yes. We have, yes, 543 we heard last Thursday. This is a new draft. We did. You have to be quick to keep up with Representative Olberg. House Bill 531 is before us. We reviewed a committee substitute briefly last week. The committee substitute J incorporates an amendment that this body adopted last Thursday, and I guess I would have to say the committee substitute provides that the museum, what is this committee called, the Museum Acquisition Committee or something.
MCAC, Mr. Chairman.
Museum Committee on Acquisitions and Advisory, Museum Advisory Commission on Acquisitions, I believe it is, MACA, I think. But,
oh, okay.
Provides they can meet by teleconference. It provides a threshold of $5,000 for their consultation. And it provides that their duties are to act in the general acquisition and deaccession policies of the museum. This is opposed to the original bill before us, which repealed or simply annulled the museum board.
Museum Collections Advisory Committee.
MCAC, Museum Collections Advisory Committee. Representative Olberg.
Mr. Chairman, perhaps I might move to adopt version J of the CS.
Yes, that's the one that is before us.
And if there's no further discussion, would you entertain a motion?
Is there objection to adopting the committee substitute? Hearing none, it is before us. Representative Olberg.
Mr. Chairman, I would move that we move CS for House Bill 531 from State Affairs with individual recommendation.
Would the committee secretary please call the roll? Representative Olmer has joined us this morning.
Representative Harvey.
Yes.
Carly, is this the version that I'd like to send out?
Yes.
Yep.
Yes.
Yes. And House Committee Substitute for House Bill 531 has passed from the House State Affairs Committee. The next item on our agenda this morning is House Bill 410, which we have previously heard. House Bill 410 pertains to real estate appraisers and the Board of Certified Real Estate Appraisers. We have before us for review a State Affairs Committee substitute. The State Affairs Committee substitute expands upon the Labor and Commerce Committee substitute in that it expands the scope of FIREA, the Financial Institution Reform, Recovery, and Enforcement Act of 1989 to bring Alaska Standards for Education, which was in the Labor and Commerce version, as well as other training requirements in line with FIREA. And it basically says that we will not exceed the federal standards for real estate appraisers, which our regulations and statutes currently do, and more than just education and training. Representative Ulmer.
Mr. Chairman, is that because there was a problem created with the existing regulations?
No, that's just a standard. The Labor and Commerce Committee proposal that was before us reduced the educational requirements in our real estate appraiser licensing to those of the federal standards. The State Affairs proposed committee substitute that, of course, reduces all the requirements, both education and training.
But I'm just wondering why.
I think the question would be why not. That was the reason for drawing up the committee substitute. Why should we have standards that exceed federal standards when we're adopting a federal standard for part of our requirements, which are in excess of our current requirements, and we're not adopting the federal standards, which are less than our current requirements?
Did we have any testimony from the board on that change? Whether they agreed with the training change?
Not that I'm aware of.
Okay, that's the only reason. I mean, the answer to why is, I guess, because we're going to assume that the federal standards are at the right level. And I'm not sure that we ever agree automatically to what the federal standards are for anything without asking ourselves first whether they're good or bad. And I guess the board has set them at some other level, probably for some reason. I don't know what it is. It would just be interesting to me to know why the board set the training requirements differently from the federal standards. And if there was a good reason, then we may not want to do it. If there wasn't a good reason, then maybe we do want to do it, but without... Is there anybody here from the board? I guess not.
I would just say that, you know, I believe our current regulations go back farther than institutional memory. Prior to the FIREA, the Federal Institution Reform, Recovery, and Reinforcement Act. And what this committee substitute is proposing is that we move in line with the rest of the country in terms of the standards that our financial institutions use to evaluate whether or not they will make a loan on a piece of property, or to the extent that they will make a loan on a piece of property. Representative Olberg.
Mr. Chairman, I think another thing that this addresses is that the federal standards continually change. I'm reading in the second paragraph of the sponsor statement that it used to be 75 hours, and then it was 105 hours, and then it was 120 hours. So if we fix a standard, a state standard, in hours, then every time the federal standard changes, we're out of compliance.
That's correct.
And if our standard is the same as the federal standard, then we're always in compliance.
Are there further questions? The The only part of the existing statutes or regulations that I'm aware of that this affects, we were affecting the educational requirements, and we had a certain number of years of training requirements. And this brings our requirements into compliance with the federal minimum requirements. And as Representative Olberg said, it does make our requirements a moving target, and we will continue to follow the federal standards. Further questions? Do you have a motion to adopt the committee substitute?
I would so move, Mr. Chairman.
Is there objection
version
to
Version O, I believe it is.
Version O. Is there objection to adopting the State Affairs Committee substitute for House Bill 410? Hearing none, the committee substitute is before us. Is there further debate? What is the pleasure of the committee? Over.
Mr. Chairman, I would move that we move committee substitute for House Bill number 410 with individual recommendations.
Would the committee secretary please call the roll?
Representative Valdez?
Yes.
Representative Peacock?
Yay.
Representative Fran Over?
Yes.
Representative
Davis? Yes.
Representative Jerry Sanders?
I suppose.
Representative Harley Over?
Yes.
And House Bill, committee substitute for House Bill number 410 has passed in the House State Affairs Committee. The next item on our agenda this morning is House Bill 530. I hope we have it ready to go this morning. Can we take a brief at ease? 8:15, House Bill 530, we still do not have a substitute prepared for that. We were looking at some changes in that. Next item on our agenda is House Bill 514. An act relating to risk-based capital for insurers. And we have with us some persons who have signed in to testify. This bill is sponsored by the House Labor and Commerce Committee. And do we have someone with Labor and Commerce Committee that would like to make a sponsor statement? No. We have Mr. David Walsh with the Division of Insurance here this morning.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman. Thank you. My name is David Walsh. I'm the Director of the Division of Insurance. With me in the back is Katie Campbell, who is our Life and Health Actuary, and who has had the primary responsibility for putting together House Bill 514. Mr. Chairman, I'm pleased to say that House Bill 514 has a zero fiscal note, and that it also has, which is unusual for an insurance bill, the support of regulators, the industry, particularly the domestic industry in Alaska, and consumer groups nationally that have taken a look at this bill. Historically, insurance company solvency has been regulated based upon a template, a one-size-fits-all outline that is laid over the financial statement of every insurance company. Whether that insurance company is the Alaska Timber Exchange or State Farm. That, over the course of the last few decades, has simply proven inadequate as a predictor of insurance company solvency or as an early warning system for a company that's heading into trouble. Over the last 4 or 5 years, insurance regulators nationally, as well as consumer groups in the industry, have worked to develop risk-based capital, which is a formula based upon the different levels of risk that an individual company may have. For example, an auto company that writes drag racing has a much higher level of risk, a much higher level of exposure than a company that just does personal passenger auto. Under the old solvency rules, they would have the same solvency margin. The one-size-fits-all template would be the only tool with which we had to work. What risk-based capital does is it sets up a formula for these various kinds of risks that results in a number. The average number that a good, solid company would have is around 580% of risk-based capital. Alaska domestic companies are between 900% of risk-based capital and 24,000% of risk-based capital. What that means, Mr. Chairman, is that the Alaska domestic companies are small, but they are very well capitalized and very strong. The strength of those companies does not come through in the traditional way of analyzing solvency. So that when these companies develop an investment strategy, when they decide whether or not they're going to grow, when they go looking for credit, they do not, the solvency laws don't allow them to present the company in as strong a light as it actually exists. So the first part of risk-based capital is that it will help Alaskan companies expand and grow. It will allow them to have an investment policy which will get a higher yield, which will hopefully result in some lower rates in addition to some growth in the domestic industry. The second thing that it does, Mr. Chairman, which is equally as important, is as a company progresses over the course of years, their risk-based capital number will hopefully stay the same or go up. If it goes down, it's something that's going to be easy for us to detect. And House Bill 514 requires that when a company reaches 200% of risk-based capital, in other words, twice the minimum amount that it needs to stay solvent, they have to come in with a rehabilitation plan. We have to know that they've got a way to work things out. At 150% of risk-based capital, we have to go in with a plan. And at 100%, we close them down. This will, I think, help ensure that problems that have happened outside that have affected Alaskan consumers won't happen again. Because, number one, we can detect the slide when it starts in a much easier and more accurate fashion. And secondly, there are some triggers where action is required. A few years ago in California with the Executive Life Company, the California Department let it go for an awful long time, and I think only time will tell whether they let it go too long. But this would ensure that that would not happen, and we would have the right to demand a rehab plan for the company or cease their writings in Alaska. This standard is currently before the legislatures of probably 30 states. And I anticipate that it will be passed in many of those states. It will become the national standard as of the end of 95. We suggested the bill, and Representative Hudson at House Labor and Commerce was kind enough to introduce it because for consideration this year, because our domestic companies are so strong that it is to their advantage to get this law on the books so they can start operating under it and so that their financial statements will accurately reflect how strong the Alaska domestic industry is. This bill has the unanimous support of the Alaska industry. Katie did a very good job of contacting all of our domestic insurance companies and also all of the major writers in Alaska. The consumer groups that have looked at it nationally and also the few consumers that have shown an interest in Alaska also think it's a good move, and we are very supportive of the bill. We have tons of information which we can give to you by the pound if you wish. Katie and I can answer any questions that you or the committee might have. This is a bill that we think is good for the consumers and good for the industry, and we highly recommend it to you and the members of the committee. Thank you,
Mr. Walsh. I was surprised that we don't have any more backup in our packet than we do. I consider this to be a major change. The current standards we're operating under have been in place for how many years?
Oh, since statehood.
Decades. I mean, in other states before that.
Mm-hmm.
And though I'm sure that there's a lot of good reasoning that goes with this proposed change, it certainly is a radical departure from practice, is it not?
It is. And Mr. Chairman, I apologize. I had thought that we had delivered a packet of information to the committee, and apparently
I'm not saying you didn't.
We will, in fact, we have some additional copies here that I would be glad to hand out now and answer questions as
you feel. And my other comment is, you say this proposal is before 30 states. This proposal has not yet been adopted by any of these, or
I do not know, Mr. Chairman.
This proposal has come from which society or which group?
From the National Association of Insurance Commissioners, which is made up of the 50 states plus the five territories and other jurisdictions in the U.S. And it's a result of about 5 years of work by the NAIC with the full participation of representatives from the industry and also consumer groups. and also the NCSL, National Conference of State Legislators, and their subgroup, NCOIL, the National Committee of Insurance Legislators.
And they've been working for how many years on this? Four or five years, and this came together, obviously fairly recently. This bill wasn't filed until about 10 days ago.
I believe it was filed fairly recently. We the final life and health formula was adopted in December, and we waited to introduce it to make sure that our domestic industry and the other big writers in the state had an opportunity to comment. We wanted to make sure that it worked for them. And the wait, I think, was a good one. We suggested one amendment, which House Labor and Commerce adopted, which was to add a public hearing requirement so that as this formula changes, we're sure that there's a procedure to Alaskanize it. And it's a relatively recent introduction, but it has had a lot of work both by the National Association and by our domestic industry and the division.
Now I see we have a Labor and Commerce Subcommittee substitute before us. What you say the change has to do with a public hearing? I mean, that's this complex bill. That's probably the one thing that we can understand the easiest. What is the role of a public hearing in a review of a organization's financial status?
The public hearing, Mr. Chairman, would be for any changes in the formula that were proposed for addition. What the bill does is it says that the national formula will be used for the main solvency tool in Alaska. Over the course of the next few years, there isn't any question that there'll be some adjustments to that formula, without question, relatively minor adjustments. This adds a public hearing requirement before any of those adjustments can be adopted by us and used by us, and it requires that it be done formally by regulation. And we think that it's a very good change. In fact, it's a change that we've sent to the National Association and suggested that they put into the national model, because our job is to protect consumers and also to make sure that whatever we do is not counterproductive to the development of the market in Alaska, and that public hearing requirement we think is a good provision.
Thank you, and I guess you kind of touched on the essence of my other question. This, I suppose it can work both ways, but as you've explained it, this bill and using this formula would allow the companies currently licensed to do business in Alaska to issue more policies. It would recognize that they had a stronger capital base than the current regulations. Mm-hmm. How does that help consumers?
Well, the biggest problem that we have, Mr. Chairman, in Alaska right now is not so much affordability, but availability. Over the last few years, for example, we have had four carriers that have 85% of the auto market: GEICO, Nationwide, Allstate, and State Farm. And we like those companies. We're glad that they're writing here. But with that kind of market concentration, there really isn't the kind of competition that leads to lower prices, product innovation, and all the things that you hope from a free market. We've worked for a number of years to bring new companies into the Alaska marketplace. As of April 1, Safeco Insurance has started to write in a major way here, and they say they want a fairly good percentage of that market share that the four companies currently enjoy. We've already seen prices start to drop as a result of the competition. In health, we have three carriers with 80% of the business: Great West, Aetna, and Blue Cross. And not anything against those companies or the four auto companies, but part of our job is to make sure that prices are as low as possible and that Alaskan consumers have the most choice possible. And that means more access, more companies is really the first order of business. And we think that this bill will help in two regards. First of all, the non-Alaskan companies that are writing here will be able to operate under what is going to become the national standard, the state-of-the-art standard. Secondly, and even more importantly, the small Alaska domestic industry that we have, and it's only 11 companies, soon to be 10 companies, will have a better competitive advantage because the strength of those small companies is going to be more apparent. So when they, with this new formula, so that when they go in for financing, they decide whether or not to expand their business, to write more policies, et cetera, they will be able to do it more easily under this formula than they would have under under the old rules. And we think that'll help. Our largest domestic carrier is Alaska National. They have a significant percentage of the workers' comp market. The other companies that we have are very good, and but they're very small. And we think that as they are able to write more business, as they are able to expand, it's going to help consumers because it's going to increase that availability. Right now, the spread is not bad, but it, in some lines, it's about a half an inch deep. You know, there's one admitted carrier that does taxi cabs. There are virtually no admitted carriers that do aviation. So we think this will help the market in those ways.
I can understand how encouraging companies to enter the market and adding competition would help consumers. But how is, I would characterize it as, and it may not be a correct characterization, I would characterize it as relaxing the financial standards of the underwriting companies. How is that going to help?
This, Mr. Chairman, this does not relax any standards. And in fact, for those companies that write higher risk insurance, and tend to have an overly aggressive investment policy with their capital and surplus, this will penalize those companies. What I think, as opposed to relaxing it, what this does is it provides a more accurate snapshot of where the company actually is. For example, if you went in to get a loan, or anyone went in to get a loan, and the bank suddenly decided they weren't going to count equity in your home in terms of the strength of your financial statement and whether or not you could repay a loan, or they weren't going to count a second income in the family, your ability to grow your business or to manage your money would go down. And if the bank all of a sudden decided to count those assets, it would not be relaxing any standards at all. It would be simply changing the rules to more accurately reflect what was there, as opposed to counting something that shouldn't be counting and relaxing the standards. The consumer groups, the National NICO, the National Insurance Consumers Organization, and others have looked at risk-based capital, and they're very supportive of it. And they certainly would not be, and I would think this hearing room would be pretty full, if they considered this to be a relaxation of the standards or an anti-consumer bill, because it's just not.
Additional questions from the committee of Mr. Walsh. Mr. Walsh, I want to thank you very much for taking the time to be
thank
with
you,
us this
Mr.
morning. I kind of suspect we're going to have some more questions, so
okay.
If you would maybe stay with us for a little while.
Sure. Thank you.
And we have a Kate Campbell with the Division of Insurance also. Did she wish to testify also?
No, Katie is our life and health actuary, and she is here to answer any questions that the committee might have.
Okay. Does the committee have any questions they'd like to ask Ms. Campbell? She is apparently prepared to answer technical questions, which I doubt the committee is prepared to ask. Okay, Representative Olberg.
I did want to mention, Mr. Chairman, that I found reading this legislation almost as much fun as reading my insurance policy.
Thank you, Representative Olberg. I'm sure that it wasn't nearly as stressful, though.
No.
Are there any other additional persons here that wish to testify on 514? Mr. Walsh, could you just join us again briefly?
Certainly.
I'm kind of surprised there's no one here from industry. Is there a reason for that? Or?
I think they're, to our knowledge, they're all very supportive of the bill. We have met with or talked to extensively over the phone with all of the representatives of, or with all the management of all the Alaska companies and all the legislative lobbyists or other representatives of the other writers in Alaska. And nobody seems to have any problem with it at all. I kind of wish they were here to testify, Mr. Chairman, but it's kind of like Yogi Berra said, if people want to stay away in droves, you can't stop them. And
yes, the great American philosopher, Yogi Berra.
Mm-hmm.
Well, with that, I appreciate your explanation. I think because of, I believe that I consider this to have a magnitude of impact, a great import. I think we'll hold it in committee for a little more review.
That's fine.
Certainly it's not the sort of legislation we want to rush into, though it's certainly, I appreciate all the work that you've done, apparently over several years on this. And if we can improve competition and service to Alaskans, well, I think we definitely want to move in that direction. President Jerry Sanders?
Were we going to get a backup packet on this?
Yes, we're going to get some more information. But because of the magnitude of this bill, I would like to hold it for some.
That's fine, Mr. Chairman. Thank you.
We'll take a brief at ease here for a few minutes. Give everybody a 5-minute break. Call the meeting back to order. The time is 8:44 a.m. April the 7th, 1994. House State Affairs Committee continuing its meeting. Next item on our agenda is House Bill 420. And we have the sponsor of that bill, Representative Gene Terrio, is with us. And Representative Terrio, let's see, our table is pretty full today. I'd like to ask you to join us, but we don't have yet. Please, in the witness seat, may I? Is Representative Davis not here?
No.
Okay.
She walked out for a moment. I'm not
Gary.
Sure she's
Gary Davis. Representative Gary Davis is not here. If you'd like to join us in his seat there. Our committee room is not quite as big as the Finance Committee room.
We get cluttered too.
Surprised,
but it's more
an observer possible. Of the human condition like yourself, Mr. Chairman, would have missed Representative Gary Davis's absence.
You're right.
Well, astounded, in fact.
I actually looked over there and visualized him sitting there. But
ooh. Perhaps you belong over at the health fair.
Vision check.
Among other things.
Okay.
But you know how it is, Reverend Olver. When you keep your head down, your ear up, you really don't know what's going on around the world.
Great timing.
We're back in order here. Representative Terrio, would you care to give us a sponsor statement?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. The Limited Liability Company is a relatively new hybrid form of business structure that combines the tax advantages of a partnership and the liability safeguards of a corporation. Although a combination of these two business structures is currently allowed in statute through formation of an S corporation, this structure has limitations that are avoided by LLCs. For example, S corporations do not allow ownership by certain type of shareholders. Under current law, corporate earnings are subject to double taxation through the payment of corporate taxes and personal taxes after distribution of dividends. LLCs avoid this double taxation by allowing earnings to flow through to individual owners in the same manner partnership income is handled. Although businesses can be organized through an S corporation to avoid double taxation and encompass some of the advantages of partnerships, they do not enjoy all the advantages of partnerships when it comes to allocating income and deductions. One of the greatest advantages is, as the name implies, the limited liability offered by the LLC structure. With LLCs, as with regular corporations, only the company's assets and not the owner's personal assets are at risk in business-related lawsuits. In partnerships, so-called limited partners enjoy such protection, but general partners do not. The limited partners face restrictions on how active they can be in the business. LLCs are designed to protect all the members while imposing no limits on their involvement in operation of the business. 34 states now permit limited liability companies, and passage in most of the remaining states is expected. Wyoming passed the first LLC Act in 1977, and other states slowly followed suit until 1988, when the Internal Revenue Service issued Revenue Rule 8876, which classified a Wyoming LLC as a partnership for federal tax purposes, even though none of the members or managers were personally liable for any of the debts of the company. Following the ruling, formation of LLCs burgeoned, with two states adopting LLC acts in 1990, four in 1991, 10 in 1992, and more than 20 states introducing measures in 1993. LLCs have tended to be family businesses, professional service firms, venture capital companies, real estate business and business startups. I believe the LLC will provide these business owners with an efficient and flexible investment vehicle that allows both limited liability and federal income tax treatment as a partnership. The bill is based on a prototype American Bar Association draft with changes to conform the bill specifically to Alaska. Mr. Chairman, that's the end of my prepared sponsor statement. I have provided a proposed committee substitute for the members to consider.
And in addition, there is a page that outlines the changes that were made since the bill passed out of the Judiciary Committee. We've been working extensively with the Alaska Bankers Association and a working group, it's the tax and business law sections, a working group from the Alaska Bar Association to make sure that the language is Alaskanized and will fit our circumstances. And with that, I also wanted to mention that, you know, if you look at the bill, it seems like it's kind of set you back just due to the length of it. But what we're doing, in essence, is just like in our state statutes, there's a hefty section in here that outline how corporations are to be formed and operate in the state of Alaska. It's basically this entire section of the statutes. What we're doing here is creating the framework for a new business structure. And so rather than tweaking its existing statutes, which is what we generally do with legislation, we're in fact creating a whole new section of statutes, and that's why the bill is as long as it is. With that, I know there are, I believe there are some people on teleconference that have been part of the working group working on the bill, and we also have the drafter here if there are technical questions. So I think we probably should just go right to the teleconference.
I have a few basic questions that are in my mind, and you certainly can affirm somebody else, but the limited liability that you referred to seemed to be, you were talking about, was an analogy to the corporate shield and whatnot. The so-called corporate shield has been pierced so many times that it's now like a screen door. Why do people think that this LLC will establish a shield protecting individuals from the liability of a business structure's activities?
Well, Mr. Chairman, I think perhaps some of the people in Anchorage can probably talk to the legal technicalities of that. And I don't want to lead you to believe that this provides any more of a shield than a corporation, because I don't believe that it does. But to the extent that you can protect your personal assets from a business-related lawsuit through a corporate structure, you'd now be able to get that same protection or same level of protection through the LLC structure. The one advantage that you would gain over the corporate structure is you would not have that double taxation. You have tax benefits, basically, to be gained through the LLC structure.
And again, maybe you want to defer on this question, but how is that different from a subchapter S corporation?
There are restrictions on what type of entities can be shareholders in a subchapter S corporation, and those same restrictions don't apply in the LLC. And again, I'm sure somebody on teleconference can answer that a little bit more technically than I have.
Okay. Are there questions from the Committee of Representative Terrio? Seeing none, we'll move to our next witness. Representative Terrio, please, you're welcome to join us. As Representative Cott comes back, why, he'll kick you out, but that's till then.
Yeah.
Representative Jerry Sanders, I'm sorry, I'm wide awake this morning. Next person on our sign-in sheet is, I can't read this, Mike.
It's Monagle.
Monagle, with the Department of Commerce and Economic Development.
Mr. Chairman,
yes, sir.
Committee members, I'm here to answer any questions that you may have. Just to give you a little background on the department's role with limited liability companies. We participate with the International Association of Corporation Administrators. In the last 10 years, LLC legislation has been a real hot topic among the states. And as the IRS has granted more and more private letter rulings to the states, and I think they're up to about 8 different letters now, and have treated the states favorably for tax purposes, there seems to be a rush toward this type of organization particularly the last 3 or 4 years. And it's anticipated, I think, by the end of 95 that all 50 states will have something in front of them. So we get probably on average 3 or 4 inquiries a week from other states wanting to come into Alaska, wanting to know if our state recognizes that type of structure. If their business was to come into our state, how would they be treated? So I think there is some business opportunity out there. Plus, as a department, I think we feel that there's a benefit to Alaska businesses to organize under this type of structure. We've worked with the department, drafted their own version last winter, submitted it to the Alaska Bar. The Alaska Bar chose to work with the American Bar prototype, and we've worked with them over the last year in developing the bill you see before you here. And with that, I'll answer any questions you might have.
Any questions, Mr. Mahogany? Representative Ulmer.
Do you have any idea how many existing companies in Alaska would probably shift over to the LLC structure?
I don't. There was some discussion at one of the committee hearings I went to. I don't think an existing corporation is going to switch over simply because of the difficulty they would encounter. The large corporations, first of all, that have shareholders, in a limited liability company, you have managers or you have members that manage. And when you have large corporations with thousands of shareholders, it's just not feasible to replace boards of directors with one manager or a group of shareholders that make those kinds of decisions. So I don't think this really is going to be attractive to major corporations. I think probably for the mom-and-pop type corporation that previously may have formed as an S corporation, they may elect to go with limited liability company because they don't have the restrictions of being a subchapter S corporation. And some of those restrictions are that you can only have one class of stock. And you cannot have alien shareholders. People from outside the country cannot be shareholders, which with our proximity to Pacific Rim, a lot of activity going on in the Far East, you could not have those type of investors participate in your business enterprise. So you only have 35 shareholders, I think, in a subchapter S2. So there's some real restrictions that LLCs would be more attractive to. There are about 1,100 corporations formed a year, and that's domestic corporations. And most of those are small corporations. I would guess probably a fair number of those, although I don't have a number, would be subchapter corporations simply to avoid the tax situation.
Mr. Monagle, you referred to the subchapter S corporations, and we're talking a little bit apples and oranges here because subchapter S corporations are established under federal law.
Correct.
And I don't even know where they come in under Alaska statute. I don't know where we recognize them in Alaska statute. We just recognize federal law, or
I believe the Department of Revenue recognizes the exemption granted by the Internal Revenue Service.
We'll go ahead and change tapes here real quick. If you're trying to compare subchapter S to an LLC, you've got the state adopting to a federal law, and now we've got in the case of LLCs, you've got the federal IRS adapting to a state law. Isn't there a great deal more uncertainty?
I believe that part of the reason LLCs have been around since the late 70s, part of the reason why there wasn't an exodus toward that type of business structure initially was that there was a question of what the IRS would do, in that Wyoming was the only state that received a private letter ruling. And I believe at this date there has been no public letter ruling by the IRS granting blanket exemption for these types of enterprises.
Blank, what do you mean by blanket exemption?
Well, for instance, if you form a subchapter S corporation that's recognized as being tax exempt. The IRS has not said that they will blanket recognize every state that comes forth with a limited liability company act. They take it state by state and take a look at the legislation that's drafted and then make a ruling based on what that state has. And that's a ruling for that state only as far as tax purposes, which I suspect would have to be something that Alaska would have to deal with after passing this type of legislation on what the IRS would rule. And I believe that's another reason why you won't see a mass exodus to this type of enterprise, is that a lot of these companies, larger companies, are not going to deal with that issue. Because 8 states or more have received private letter rulings, I've talked with IRS representatives that are studying this as a working group. They've come to our conferences and talked to us. I believe probably in the next 5 years, and this is my personal opinion, that the IRS will come up with some type of blanket ruling. They've indicated that they will.
You indicated that you get 3 or 4 calls in some period of time, I can't remember what it was, about outside interest.
Correct.
Wanting to know about LLC structure. Was that 3 or 4 calls a week or a month?
Weekly.
Now, would three or four viable business enterprises a week actually be considering jumping into a vague IRS status, or they just simply don't know what's here?
Well, they have already formed a limited liability company under their own state.
In their own state.
Washington or Oregon have passed LLC legislation. And so they want to know how would they be treated in Alaska. They don't want to come into Alaska and not have their structure recognized and put their limited liability at risk, basically, be treated as a general partnership or some other way under the Alaska court system. So I think it's part of their decision process on whether to do business in our state or do business in Washington is how will we treat them. And I believe that that is a consideration that they have to make before deciding where they want to locate their business.
And they aren't aware when they're calling that we don't have this and we don't have an IRS ruling.
A lot of the companies do not. These are not calls from law firms. Most of them are calls from comptrollers and service companies from other states.
Well, I was just going to ask, what kind of companies are there that are like three or four a week that are thinking about doing business here, but for whom the LLC status is critical? I mean, who are they?
Usually we don't get into those kinds of discussions. They want to know where we're at with legislation. I know the calls come from all over the country, from Florida, from the East Coast, from the West Coast.
Who actually are thinking about coming to Alaska to do business?
They're inquiring into our legislation. So I'm assuming that they could be doing studies, they could be finding out, making a business decision, and that factor being part of their business decision.
Yeah, I'm just trying to visualize. I mean, are these quote unquote the small business mom pop type who are coming to think about opening a gift shop in Fairbanks, who are they?
I don't think so. The states that developed limited liability company legislation first, and again, that's my personal opinion, were those states that do a lot of resource development. Colorado, Wyoming, a lot of those states in that area. And I think most of our corporations now that deal with mineral extraction are foreign-owned, Canadian-owned. So I think that this is an attractive alternative for them. Setting up, coming in, if they've already formed under their state laws or under Canada or wherever they're at, that they want to come in and enjoy the same protection in Alaska that they enjoy where they're at. But as far as what they do, I'm not sure.
Chairman Terrio, you had a comment or question?
Well, Mr. Chairman, in addition to the request for wanting to know where the state of Alaska is with regards to this business structure, my wife is an attorney, deals with business laws and business practice in Fairbanks, and she has had 2 to 3 people a month ask her who want to form a business and are looking at the list of possible business structures that they can form under, and have asked, generally I think after the suggestion from their accountant, whether the LLC form is available in the state of Alaska. So what we're trying to do for people in the state of Alaska who are thinking about forming a business is add this to the list of possible structures that they can consider. And if it's to their advantage, we want to offer them this opportunity.
Additional questions? Mr. Mono, thank you very much for being with us, and you might, if you would, stay with us for a little longer. I don't see any other persons present signed in to testify on this bill. We do have some people, I understand, by teleconference. I have no indications of who's with us by teleconference.
Mr. Chairman, this is Bob Manley from Anchorage. May I testify at this point?
Please, if you would, give us your address and affiliation.
Certainly. My name is Bob Manley. I'm an attorney with Hughes Services, Gans, Howell, and Brundine in Anchorage. My address is 3248 Cook, Anchorage, 99501. I'm appearing, testifying as an individual, acting as chairman of a working group of members of the tax and business law sections of the Bar Association, who have been active in developing this legislation. As indicated, the legislation before you was drawn from the American Bar Association Prototype Act, with significant input from the banking community and the corporation section and other interested persons. I read in the Wall Street Journal last week that the count is now up to 38 states that have adopted this limited liability company legislation. The state senate in California just passed limited liability company legislation by a 39-0 vote, and it's expected to be on the governor's desk shortly. Limited liability companies provide a blend of corporate and partnership tax and operational characteristics. They provide a flexible operating system plus federal income tax advantage to the members. They also provide estate planning advantage, and they facilitate foreign investment because non-resident aliens may not be subchapter S corporation shareholders. Subchapter S corporations are simply corporations that are tax classified basically, and again, in short form, basically like partnerships, so they avoid the double taxation, but nonetheless have the liability shield of corporations. Limited liability companies will mostly replace entities such as subchapter S corporations and partnerships. There was a question, how many entities will change over to limited liability companies? Basically, few, if any, regular corporations will change over simply because the transactional costs and the tax costs of changing would be too significant. However, some partnerships will change over. A few sub-S corporations may change over, but nonetheless, I think most of them will have a certain amount of tax consequence, so they won't change over. They'll simply live with the existing limitations. For those people considering forming a new business venture, with limited liability company legislation, they'll have a new option. And a number of people that would have formed partnerships or S corporations will now form limited liability company legislation. There was also a question regarding the uncertainty of tax classification. The Internal Revenue Service doesn't like to issue blanket rulings. And in fact, with our Alaska version of the Uniform Limited Partnership Act, which the legislature adopted in 1992, the IRS has still not issued a ruling as to whether that will be classified as a partnership for tax purposes. I think everybody believes it will, but the IRS moves at its own pace and its own speed. At this time, our working group has already opened up informal communication with the IRS, and the IRS has indicated that they will open a revenue ruling project, in other words, a consideration of how matters will be taxed, or how an LLC will be taxed as soon as legislation is passed. So I expect that we will be able to resolve any uncertainty regarding tax classification relatively promptly. Thank you. That ends my testimony, but I'm certainly available to take any questions.
Thank you, is it Manley?
Manley, M-A-N-L-E-Y.
You mentioned an area of corporate shield or limited liability, or maybe you'll use another phrase. Under the current corporate structures and the evolution of the law over the decades, I mean, that corporate shield is getting pretty thin. I mean, we see corporate officers going to jail. We see boards of directors being held liable for all kinds of things. How would you compare this to the shield that the LLC would offer?
I do not think that the LLC will offer any greater shield than the current corporate shield. While the operating systems may be a little bit different, still members, directors, managers, whichever regime you're operating in, are still going to be tagged in some circumstances for their own individual act. It's no different than if I took out the company car and caused a car accident. Not only would the company be potentially liable, but I personally, as the driver of that car, would be personally liable. So, I guess in summary, an LLC doesn't provide any general protections, and certainly the members would be subject to the same kind of piercing the corporate veil or piercing the limited liability company veil argument. So there's no change, no significant change in that regard. We aren't offering any additional protections. It simply provides some protection.
I guess one of the things that would go through my mind, Mr. Manley, would be anyone who sits on a board of directors needs to give consideration to, I can't remember what the policy is called, but a director's liability insurance policy.
Absolutely. Even, and it's an issue that that many people miss, even when you're serving on a non-profit volunteer board that's handling significant amounts of money, it's very important to maintain that kind of insurance. In addition, our corporate code does allow corporations to indemnify officers and boards, members of the board of directors. Similarly, the limited liability company legislation before you draws from the corporate code to allow that kind of indemnity. So certainly members and officers, directors can provide themselves with some protection there if the business entity is willing. But you're absolutely right. It's a difficult environment out there, and directors and officers' liability insurance or its equivalent are very important.
But how is that going to relate to an LLC? Are all partners going to need to carry a partner's liability insurance policy?
Well, there are two ways you can operate a limited liability company, either member-managed or manager-managed. And in a manager-managed LLC, I think it would be certainly appropriate for the managers, just like the directors of a corporation, to secure directors and officers insurance or its equivalent. Now, in a member-managed limited liability company, again, it's something that it may be prudent to obtain in order to provide additional protection. Some businesses may elect not to simply because they were previously operating as partners and they didn't have any protection before, and they could live with that. And now they're getting some protection, but that's going to have to be an individual consideration, and some people will elect to have that additional insurance.
Are there further questions, Mr. Manley? Thank you for your testimony, Mr. Manley, and do we have someone else there in Anchorage?
Yes, my name is Peter Brodick. I'm a shareholder with Arctic Rose, Norman Mahoney, and Edwards.
I'm sorry, could you repeat your name, please?
My name is Peter Brodigan.
And I'm sorry, Mr. Brodigan, before we start your testimony, could we ask Mr. Manley to state his address again for clarity? It didn't come across very clear.
Certainly. It's 324 East Cook, COOK, Anchorage, 99501.
Thank you. And Mr. Brogan, if you would give us your address and your testimony, please.
Sure. My address is 2170 Belmont Drive, Anchorage, 99517. My practice primarily entails business and transactional tax planning, along with significant estate planning. We're seeing that the LLC as being a viable alternative for many clients, although not here readily available in Alaska. It is something that's being considered, obviously, in ventures that are being proposed here in Alaska that have been organized in other states. We believe that with the LLC, this is going to be something that is necessary for Alaska to stay involved in commerce in the long run, because the LLC provides some wonderful opportunities that are not there currently under the current business venture structures. For example, with an S corporation has already been testified to, the number of investors were limited to, we can only have U.S. citizens be shareholders. With an LLC, there are no limitations as to the number of investors who might be involved. You can have trusts who might be involved. You can have other partnerships that can be involved. All these types of investors are not allowed under the S corporation status. The other benefit is that there can be participation in management, just like in a regular corporation, but would not be allowed under a limited partnership type of theory. So if someone wanted to be a limited partnership, they could not participate in management, whereas in the LLC that is possible. As already stated, Wyoming was the first one to adopt the LLCs, which were really, I would say, history goes back to Europe, where the LLCs were first formed, maybe in Germany or France. But the LLC has been on the North American continent now for something like 17 years. One question has been raised about the corporate veil. Again, the LLC is not going to provide any more protection for its investors than a corporation already has. We see typically in my practice, there are numerous clients who do not maintain their corporations, and it's their job, as in any type of business venture, to maintain the formalities of the vehicle that they're operating through, so that the law will respect their corporation and protect them from that liability. Although there are things like director liability and other liabilities that do go through, the theory of piercing the corporate veil, as long as the corporation is maintained, is going to protect the investors from, and keep their personal assets from those liabilities. That would be true with the LLC, and all the formalities would have to be maintained to protect the individual investors. The type of businesses that we're seeing interested in these are entities from other states that have LLC legislation, but primarily mining ventures and fishing operations and entities that want to invest through trust or other partnerships. The LLC provides a wonderful opportunity to facilitate that type of business venture, which is obviously not currently available yet. That's the end of my testimony. I'd be happy to answer any questions you might have.
I guess I have one question that you bring up, Mr. Protigan, and that's director liability versus LLC partner liability. Individual members of a board of directors are indeed held liable for a lot of things, particularly taxes. How is that going to translate over to an LLC partner?
I think what you're referring to, and correct me if I'm wrong, is the 100% penalty that is imposed by the Internal Revenue Service, which has now gotten a new name and it escapes me, but it's under Section 6672 of the Internal Revenue Code, which basically says that if you as a director, officer, manager of the corporation direct funds to someone other than the Internal Revenue Service, primarily related to withholding taxes, you can be held responsible as a responsible person for the payment of those taxes. That same rule under federal law would also apply to an LLC, absolutely. Other taxes, though, I'm not aware of directors being held liable for other taxes of a corporation. And if you could, if there's any other thought on that, I'd be happy to try to address that also.
No, I was addressing withholding taxes, and I don't, maybe they changed the name, maybe they don't call it a penalty anymore, maybe they call it a contribution, but... that's what I'm referring to, and you're talking about a situation where a manager doesn't make a withholding payment. Members of the board are fiduciarily responsible. How is that going to translate over to an LLC?
As under current federal law, if you are a responsible person, a person who's responsible for making those withholding payments, and you willfully fail to pay those over to the Internal Revenue Service, yes, you can be held responsible for the payment of those withholding taxes. Therefore, as a director or investor or person involved in an LLC, if you are responsible for withholding the taxes from the paycheck and willfully fail to pay those over to the Internal Revenue Service, the same federal law would apply both to a regular corporation as we currently have it and to the LLC members. Absolutely. There would be no change under the current state law that we're proposing.
Okay, I guess that answered my question sufficiently. It's the real question in my mind isn't so much the wording intentionally, but the interpretation, meaning that boards of directors are expected to exercise responsible oversight, and failure to do that is usually interpreted as intentional neglect.
My experience under 6672 of dealing with the 100% penalty is that there has to be pretty flagrant disregard of the rules before the IRS will hold you actually responsible. They try frequently to claim that a person has done that, but it often comes down to the fact that the person either did not have the responsibility or did not willfully make the payment to someone other than the Internal Revenue Service. In better words, if I just sit on, for example, at my law firm, I sit on the board of directors, but I have no ability to sign checks at this point, I could not be held responsible, because I cannot direct funds to someone else if I cannot sign checks.
And you're saying that this analogy will extend over to the LLC?
Absolutely.
Are there further questions of Mr. Rodigan? Representative Terrio.
Mr. Chairman, I just, Representative Ulmer handed me a note that had a question about the potential impact to the state treasury from the loss of corporate taxes. And I really don't think that there's going to be that loss, or that loss will be experienced. Corporations, as was testified to earlier, there will probably be no corporations because of tax penalties and the difficulty in dropping that structure to move to an LLC, I don't expect any corporations to make a structural change. The businesses that may now select this business structure are most likely going to be those that would have chosen either partnership or subchapter S, which there are no state corporate taxes on either of those business entities, so there really should be no impact to the state treasury. It is difficult, though, to project into the future with 100% certainty to say that somebody that would have formed a corporation sometime in the future may now select this alternative form. But when you get up to the size of a business that would have paid any kind of significant corporate taxes, I think that business is still going to want a pure corporate structure.
Well, if I may comment, I mean, our corporate tax is a misnomer because it doesn't apply to corporations, it applies to any business entity. If that business entity, a person other than a natural human being, has a profit on operating under a business license, then they're subject to the corporate tax. If the LLC, I would assume, not having thoroughly read the bill, I would assume that the LLC, if it shows a profit, retains earnings, in other words, that it would be subject to the same tax. And if I'm wrong, maybe somebody can correct me.
Well, my understanding, and perhaps one of the gentlemen in Anchorage could answer more fully, you'd be treated just like a partnership, or the way that a partnership would be treated for taxes.
I guess the question is, how would an LLC then ever accumulate capital and retained earnings?
This is Brian Durrell in Anchorage. I'd be happy to address the tax question if you'd like.
I'm sorry, your name, sir?
My name is Brian Durrell.
If you would, please state your name and affiliation and address, Mr. Durrell.
Sure. The name again is Brian Durrell, T-U-R-R-E-L-L. I am a CPA and a lawyer. I currently practice with the firm of Ogle and Gates in Anchorage. My address is 1031 West 4th, Suite 600, Anchorage, Alaska, 99501. And I've been quite involved in the legislation, House Bill 420, that is before you. Initially, with the working group here in Anchorage, made up of lawyers and CPAs who worked with the ABA prototype in making modifications so that it would better conform to Alaska law. And then throughout the legislative process, a couple of weeks ago, I went down to Juneau and spent 2 days working with a subcommittee of the House Judiciary Committee, making some fairly substantial modifications to the bill to address a few concerns that had been raised. On addressing specifically this question about taxes, under Alaska state law, the only income taxes that we have are assessed against corporations that are known as regular corporations or C corporations. S corporations, which is no different under state law than any other corporation, but has made a special election under the Federal Internal Revenue Code, to be taxed as if it were akin to a partnership, a flow-through tax where the profits and losses of the corporation are allocated to the shareholders. S corporations are not subject to Alaska income tax. Partnerships are not subject to Alaska income tax, only C corporations. Under this bill, HB 420, where an LLC would be formed, there would really be an option of the organizers to structure it either as a corporation subject to tax or as a partnership. I believe that most of the organizers of LLC will opt for the partnership sort of structure. That is the primary tax advantage, to have a tax as a partnership. Under state law, an LLC that was organized as a partnership would not be subject to tax. The income of the LLC would flow through to the members, would be allocated to the members, and since there is no personal income tax, they would not report it or pay tax on it in Alaska. But this is no different than any other partnership organized in Alaska or operating in Alaska, doing business in Alaska, or any S corporation doing business in Alaska. Same analysis there, they would not be subject to tax, but rather the income and losses of the S corporation or partnership would be allocated to the partners or the shareholders of the S corporation, and would be reported on K-1s that they would receive.
So, in order for a LLC or a partnership or an S corporation to accumulate capital or retained earnings, the individual partners would have to pay the taxes on the retained earnings.
That's right. The individual members of an LLC would pay taxes on any allocable share of the profits of the LLC. And it really would not matter whether those profits were retained as retained earnings or retained capital of the LLC, or if those earnings were distributed.
Hey, Representative Ulmer?
Well, let me ask this question, because looking at it from the perspective of trying not to have a significant revenue impact to the state of Alaska, I am concerned about which kinds of companies may opt to do this in the future and thereby potentially reducing state revenues. And so when it was mentioned previously that some mining companies and fishing companies were calling to see whether the LLC structure was available in Alaska, if they were able to organize it in that manner, they would be able to avoid state corporate income taxes. If they are required, as it is now, to choose between partnership and corporate status, they may choose corporate status even though they have to pay income taxes, but because of the certain liability protections. So if we're giving them this as an alternative, it may make it more attractive. Obviously, it will make it more attractive to go this route, because not only will they get the liability protection, they'll also be able to avoid state income tax for corporations. So that's quite a benefit, and I just would like some sort of reassurance that this isn't going to be a significant number. Representative Theriault mentioned that it probably wouldn't be in the interest of many existing entities to do that, but for the new companies entering the state, is this going to be a big deal?
No, I don't believe that it will be a significant, I don't believe that there will be any significant loss of tax revenues to the state. Certainly mining companies, fishing companies, other businesses like that that have operated in the traditional corporate structure could use an LLC, but they're not going to use it to replace the corporate structure that they currently have. They're going to replace it, they're going to use it to replace a joint venture structure, and there will be no consequence of loss of revenues. And let me give you an example, one that I have some familiarity with. It's near to Juneau, Greens Creek Mine. I was involved in the organization of that. Greens Creek is set up as a joint venture. What is it? It's the time to open. It's the largest mining silver mine in the world, or in the United States, rather. There are, I don't know, half a dozen different corporations. These are all large corporations. Came to Alaska to open that mine, operate the mine. They looked for a vehicle an entity, business entity, to conduct business in. The one that they selected was a joint venture, because that would give them the pass-through tax benefits. The profits, losses of the joint venture would pass through to the corporate owners of the mine, and they would report those profits on their corporate tax returns under what's now Water's Edge corporate tax system. The reference earlier to the use that mining companies could make of this is that they could make their investments in Alaska more efficient. Rather than using a joint venture that they would invest in, they would perhaps choose an LLC as the form and get the same flow through of tax benefits, same partnership tax flow through, and then the profits would be reported and tax paid on them in Alaska. But the reason that they likely would choose an LLC over a joint venture, or perhaps would, is because of the limited liability aspect. And what they have to do when they go into a project like Greens Creek, and again, that's just an example, is they have to form a corporate subsidiary which holds the joint venture interest in order to get that limited liability. And you end up with a half a dozen publicly held corporations, each with wholly owned subsidiaries, and the wholly owned subsidiaries each are joint venture partners. Under the new format, it will be much more efficient, easy for those corporations to operate, because they can avoid the intermediary wholly owned subsidiary. The corporations can just have a membership interest in the LLC, and it won't have any impact on tax revenues to the state. And it's in that type of a context that we suspect large mining companies or fishing companies would conduct business in Alaska and utilize the LLC.
Would you mind giving me your phone number so that I could follow up with you on this?
Sure. 257-7828.
Thank you.
Are you volunteering to be a subcommittee, Representative Ulmer?
Oh, I just have some questions, and I'd like to talk to him.
In light of that, are there further questions from the committee? Seeing none, Representative Elmer, would you like to hold this bill for further? Would you like to have further testimony on this bill? Or?
Well, if you don't mind holding it at least until the next time we meet, I'd appreciate it.
Okay. I don't see a problem with that.
Mr. Chairman, when would that be, and will that make the deadline for moving House bills to House rules?
No, it wouldn't make the deadline. It would be next Thursday. It would be a week from today. However, I think that given there is a companion bill of this in the Senate, isn't there?
Yes, but the Senate bill has been held waiting arrival of the House bill.
Okay, well, but they have heard it. I just think this would be one. This is a major piece of legislation. I don't think we'd have any trouble getting a waiver of our internal rule that we could treat it more like a Senate rule. We're going to be hearing Senate bills until the 20th of April, so personally I'm confident that if I, as a committee chair, requested that we'd be given a week extension, that I think we could do that.
Okay.
Because this is a major piece of legislation. I think it's a good piece of legislation, but I think there are some legitimate concerns that we need to be able to address. We got next item on our agenda. We do have a very few minutes left. Is House Bill 393, the unincorporated community grants, and we'll not be getting back to SB 303 today. Ms. Lazier, I'm sorry, we just don't have time. We'll hear it next Thursday, a week from today. Pardon? Please, if you may. Let's see, on HB 393, we had Karen Brand is here to answer questions, and Crystal Smith with the AML is here to testify. Ms. Smith, she's still with us? Not still with us? The questions, we had some questions about financing of the additional cities, and we have had some information prepared. Mr. Ryan, you have worked on getting this information on grants prepared. Could you join us at the table and explain this report to us?
I'm Joe Ryan. I work for Representative Albizzi. Concern from some of the organized communities, Fairbanks, North Star Borough, and where we live, was whether they were going to lose revenue for this program to go into effect. The financial officer with whom I had a discussion yesterday, Judy Slazier, felt that it would be about a 10% loss for them. They would receive $120,000, perhaps less money under this program than they were. But this is a breakout. This was done by a person over administration as to what the allocations would be. There is a legislative function in this. There will be two programs set up, and the legislature will allocate a certain amount of funds to the this rural program and then the capital funds for the other program, it's my understanding. And this is basically a breakout of what each community by name would be eligible to receive in this program if this this piece of legislation in fact becomes a law. So it basically gives you a scenario of dollars, population, the grant numbers, and what their match will be. The question I wasn't able to get an answer to was whether the percentage of grant would be reduced for the smaller communities. That's 30%, I understand, for larger ones. And whether it still is 30% or whether there was a reduction in the percentage. That's the only question I haven't had an opportunity to explore.
Are there questions of Mr. Ryan? So it's the information we have here. Mr. Ryan, if you could answer some more questions about this chart here. What we have here is how the program would break out if this becomes law.
That's a what-if scenario, yes.
So we don't have a comparison of what it is if it doesn't become law at this time.
No, I've been trying to. The people, unfortunately, we have a lot of folks who are sick in different departments that are handling this. I don't know if that has anything to do with sunny days or not, but the folks aren't there. And I've been having a bit of trouble. I wanted to get a what-if scenario of what's now versus what this will be to present to you. And I haven't been able to contact people to get that. The other half of the scenario.
Okay, but the indication is that the extra grants to the unincorporated communities within boroughs would be allocated out of the total program receipts.
Well, my understanding of this is, well, it's an allocation made by the legislature, how much they want to put into each program, but there's a formula for this. My understanding is that it goes by population figures, and there's a central pie. Depending on how many people you have, it's an arcane formula, and then you get your particular match, your piece of the pie, depending upon your population. If the population in the borough were reduced, the numbers were encountered, then you proportionally receive less money. If you had local communities in there that were figured individually, that would subtract from the total population figure, so then the share of the pie for the larger community would be proportionally reduced.
Okay, but it appears that the formula is of the neighborhood in boroughs about $10 per citizen. That's just in round numbers. So if you have a community of, say, Salcha with 400 people.
Well, according to this, there's a minimum. You look at the first one. They have 78 people, and they're going to receive $25,000.
But Salcha represents, say, 400 people in the Fairbank North Star Borough, and because of that, Fairbank North Star Borough gets, say, $4,000. But under this program, if Salcha was indeed eligible, Salcha would get $25,000, and that money would come out of the pool somewhere.
So the population would be reduced.
And the population for the Fairbank North Star Borough would be reduced. They would get $4,000 less. Plus the total pool will be reduced by $25,000.
On a formula of population program, yeah, because it's all figured on the total population as to what your percentage of the pie is by the formula of the allocation.
Okay. Are there questions of Mr. Ryan? That looks like almost a question, Representative Davis, but
yeah, it was
Representative Olver.
I noticed that Crystal Smith is returned, Mr. Chairman, okay. If you wanted to hear from her.
They perhaps are more knowledgeable about the program than I.
Representative Davis?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, you're correct. It would reduce the amount to the borough. However, in most cases, the borough would probably be spending or would have a project they would be funding in that unincorporated area anyway. So it may, but that's just a maybe. It's still, that money is still going to that municipality, to the borough. But Salcha may have a project that the borough would be funding from there.
Well, I say Salcha. I see Salcha didn't make their list here.
Whichever. Another.
I just tried to give an example that I was familiar with.
Well, this whole thing hinges on legislative appropriation, because there will be two particular appropriations: one for the small unincorporated communities, and then there'll be a larger one. My understanding. Mm-hmm.
Okay. Let's see.
Perhaps Ms. Brand can give you a little more of that detail on there. I'd rather duck it at this time.
Well, Ms. Smith is with the AML is here, and we'll try to get her testimony in real quick because we have to adjourn very shortly. Ms. Smith, we'd like to take your testimony. We won't take action on this bill today because we're moving a little quickly here. But
thank you, Mr.
Sorry
Chairman.
Sorry for the very brief time, but we have just a few moments.
That's fine. I only have a brief statement. I don't know what you've discussed. I'm sorry I was out dealing with some other business, but just speaking on behalf of the Municipal League and from the municipal point of view, I think there are two concerns that you need to have about this bill. One, as I think Mr. Ryan was discussing, if this would shift funding within a borough from the borough government to the unincorporated communities, so you'd have that shift. And yes, your borough as a total would have more money, but it's a shift from an organized government structure to an unorganized government structure. And the other thing is, in the absence of additional funding for the program, and given the letter of intent that was included from the CNRA committee, the effect of adding a bunch of unincorporated communities would be to reduce every incorporated community's share of the total appropriation, because as Mr. Ryan said also, there's an appropriated amount, and if that needs to be spread over more communities because more communities are getting the minimum entitlement, as you noted, the minimum entitlement is 25, even though the borough might have lost less than that, so there's a net need for additional funds or a net decrease for municipal governments. And I think this is just another example of a disincentive to organization of local government. I mean, there are lots of things that the legislature is considering and taking action on that are disincentives to government organization, and if that's the way you're interested in going, then I think spreading this out to more unincorporated communities is another way to do it. I don't happen to think that's the best public policy, but you need to look at that.
Your testimony that if we want to go to a different way other than organized boroughs, this would be a good policy.
Well, I don't know that I'd say that. I just say it's another disincentive for people remaining organizing and for organizing in the first place.
Well, thank you very much for being with us, Ms. Smith, but we do have to adjourn. The time is 9:43, and we have a joint session coming up.